No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I hope my show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. Today, we're very lucky to have with us the auditor from the District of Columbia, Kathy Patterson. Kathy is the D.C. auditor. She was unanimously confirmed by the council, which really says a lot about her character. And she came after working for the Pew Charitable Trust, a great organization, for 10 years, worked on things like education policy and government relations. And she was a three-term council member from my ward, Ward 3. Thanks so much for being with us, Kathy. We're happy to
have
you.
My pleasure. My pleasure. Happy to be with you.
Well, I got to tell you, you probably don't remember this, but I got to start by telling you the story of how we met. I met you because I got elected to the city, to ANC Commission. And the ANC Commissioner, for people that don't know, is a volunteer position here in Washington. They're neighborhood commissioners. Well, I happen to live in a neighborhood where Councilwoman Patterson was my member of the council. So they called me the day before my swearing in, and they said, Kathy Patterson's going to come swear you in. And I said, oh, that's great. So I dressed up. I put my best suit on. Mrs. Brown got dressed up. We went there. You showed up right on time. And because the person that ran against me withdrew, they handed you a piece of paper to read for my swearing in. It basically said, since you were the only one, since no one else came forward, since there was you and no one else, you know, and then you went on. And my wife and I had to laugh. My wife said to me, why didn't they just have her say, since you were the only dumb enough in the neighborhood to do this, we're going to swear you. But that's how I met you, and I've been a fan of yours ever since.
Well, thank you. And you've been a public official ever since, pretty much.
Yeah, I really have. Yeah, I really have. Maybe I shouldn't like you so much for putting my feet on that path. But yeah, it's been a great experience for me. And you know, living in D.C., I started my journey. I was in national politics for 30 years, ran a consulting firm, worked on many presidential campaigns. But my journey in D.C. started because my great-great-great-grandfather was in the Revolutionary War when he was 17 years old. And I thought to myself, what would he think of me just sitting around doing nothing while these people have taken all our rights that he fought so hard for? So that's why I started. And it's been a great trip. And it's been great. I'm going to retire in January. But before I go, I had to talk to you because I see you every year at performance hearings, and you're just honest and forthright. And you answer all the questions, and you know, you don't back down from the chairman. A lot of people do that when he asks questions. They're like, oh, but you have the temerity to tell him the truth. And I so admire that in you. But let me ask you a question about D.C. Is our bureaucracy bloated? I mean, we have 680,000 people, and we have 41,000 government workers, whereas in L.A. County has 10 million people, and they have 100,000 employees. They have a little more than twice as many employees, but they have almost 15 times the population. Is our bureaucracy too big in D.C., you think?
I think it is bloated, absolutely. But one thing you do need to keep in mind, your listeners need to keep in mind, we are a city, a county, and a state. So
yeah.
You can't always just compare us to just a city or just a county or whatever. But having said that, our population hasn't changed significantly in the last decade, but our number of D.C. government employees has gone up by a huge amount, something in the range of 28%. And we're putting out a data brief sometime soon that will look at some of those numbers because the numbers really have gone up considerably. And, you know, there are a bunch of factors there, but it does look pretty big in terms of numbers.
Yeah, and we have an amazing budget, right? $20 billion these days.
That's the total funds budget. About 11 billion of that is DC tax dollars, DC money raised here right here in the district.
Yeah. I know because I pay property taxes in the district, but the district has some great property tax laws. I got to tell you, I'm over 65, so I get a discount. I live in my house, so I get a discount, and those are all good policies, I think, to keep people in the district. You know, it cuts down on rental properties and increases home ownership, and I think all that
right.
stuff is very good.
Right. There's also the cap. You know, the cap on your valuation of your property
right.
going up. Yeah.
Right. And it's skyrocketed since I've been here. I can't tell you. My wife and I are now, because we have a gigantic house. You'll relate to this because you have children and grandchildren. But we have a gigantic house that we don't need anymore because our kids are all grown. But every one of them is complaining that we're selling their house because they come home once a year for Christmas. We need to keep a 3,300 square foot house so they can come home for Christmas.
Well, and some of those things are important now. Come on.
I know they are. And what did I tell them, Kathy? I said, as soon as you bring some grandchildren with you, then we could, you know, if you had a few grandchildren, we could fill up the rooms. But no, they're too lazy to do that. So we're working on selling the house. And I can't tell you, I invested when I bought this house because I was self-employed. Nobody wanted to give me a mortgage. You know, they said, oh, we need 10 years of tax returns and, you know, we need a blood sample. And I mean, it was just ridiculous. So I put 50% down on the cost of this house. I put a 50% down payment. And at that point, they were like, yeah, do whatever you want. But I invested the same amount of money in the stock market, and they both grown at exactly the same rate. The property value on my house has quadrupled since we moved in.
Your equity must be just way up there.
Property
values, absolutely.
It absolutely amazes me, and my wife too were like, what? And you know, I have a kid that lives in Chicago and a kid that lives in Denver, and they don't come back to Washington because it's too expensive to live. My son, who's here and graduated from college, came back, runs a Ace Hardware store. He lives in a room that he pays $2,000 a month for, and I swear when he's in bed, he can touch both walls. So, you know, and a nice house, though, but in a group house. And we don't know how people can afford to live here anymore. And I understand the Trust for Historic Preservation. I understand the trust fund is running out of money. And to build affordable housing, and we really need to deal with that problem. So anything, I know you have so much policy experience. Is there some policy change we should be making so that we can deal with the affordable housing thing? Because I know the council put a freeze on rents during the pandemic, and of course people didn't pay the rent. You know, even people probably that could have afforded to pay the rent didn't pay the rent because they didn't have to. And, you know, we should know that happens. So is there a policy change we should make that would improve that, you think?
I think there's sort of an overarching policy approach that we should be looking at across all of our expenditures, and that is to make sure we're getting value for each and every one of those dollars. And when you look at all the effort that goes into building a budget every year, the unfortunate part is there's much, much less attention into what happens after that budget is approved. Where do the dollars go, and how effectively are they spent? And there's just not very much close oversight looking at all of the expenditures. And that's something that we try to do through some of our audits. But again, that our work is pretty small in terms of the total amount of programs that we have an opportunity to look at. But we do make recommendations from time to time. And some of the housing approaches really do merit looking at a lot more closely. We're going to have a report coming out looking at the inclusionary zoning program in a month or so. And I hope that'll be helpful in terms of the council and the executive in improving that program.
Well, I think you do a great job at that, and you try very hard. Your office is very good. It's one of the best in the D.C. government, I would say. And you know what? You stand. One of the things I admire about you is there's a real gap in every government between the politicians and the bureaucrats, right? The great German philosopher Jürgen Habermas said there's always a gap between theory and practice. And the politicians, unfortunately, are the theorists, and you and the other people that work for the D.C. government are the practitioners. So that's a very hard balance, right? Because we always want to do everything for everybody. Right?
We're but we're not. We're sort of somewhere in a gray area in between.
Yeah.
We are not the practitioners. We're the accountability police. We're the folks who try to say, okay, how are you doing? And is this working?
Right.
And is this doing what it set out to do? And that kind of thing. So we, you know, yes, we are bureaucrats, I suppose, but we try to work with the practitioners and try to come up with recommendations that the practitioners can agree with and maybe implement. So we're sort of in, as I say, that kind of gray area in between the politicians and the practitioners.
Well, that's what I admire you about you, because it's very tough territory. And, you know, I've worked mostly in politics in my life, and I know that politicians want to give away the store. And after they've done it, like you say, you need oversight to make sure the money's being implemented, because we don't care anymore. We just, everybody's happy. You're going to elect me. I gave you a bunch of money. Yay. You know, so we really do need people to look after it. And that's a problem. We had a guy in D.C. who I know you know that everybody loved, named Netwar Gandhi. He, you know, all the people, I don't know that everybody loved him, but I know that people in power thought he was a great practitioner. But he left office after a scandal where $40 million was taken by an employee, $40 million in the Tax and Revenue Office. And when it came out that what was happening was she was writing $100,000 refund checks to people that she knew on property taxes, I was absolutely amazed by that, because I'm thinking to myself, who gets a $100,000 refund on their property tax? The Verizon Center, maybe, or right? Who pays millions of dollars in property taxes? And the woman was driving a Bentley to work every day and had houses all up and down the East Coast, and nobody knew anything about it until the person that caught her was actually a bank teller when she tried to deposit a check over $10,000. And, you know, there's a law that says if you make a transaction in a financial institution in excess of $10,000, it's reported to the IRS. So that was what started the investigation and finally got her called. So what do we need to do about that stuff internally, before it comes to your office, before you're the people that have to look at it? Are there changes that we need to make internally to make sure that there's enough oversight?
Absolutely. And we do, the District of Columbia is subject to an annual, we used to be called the CAFR, it's now the Act for Annual Comprehensive Financial Report. But in the case that you're talking about, the Harriet Walters scandal, that $40 million lost from the Treasury, the council actually followed that up with a very thorough report on what happened. And the council hired outside counsel, and the outside counsel hired Price Waterhouse. They came up with a very, very good report looking at different internal controls that the Office of the Chief Financial Officer needed to have in place to make sure that that kind of thing didn't happen again. And that report is actually something that I took a look at just recently, because one of the things that I'm wondering about is whether we should go back in and look at all of those recommendations and make sure they were all implemented. Because again, that was a number that was more than a decade ago. That was a while ago. And it may be that with a new financial system having been put in place in the district, that maybe it's time to sort of take another look to make sure that the new system itself is meeting all the control requirements that were surfaced when that happened. My assumption is that everything is sort of where it should be, but it never hurts to go back and do another look and say, okay, so, you know, 15 years ago, there were these recommendations. Are they all still in place?
Right.
So that's something that we may want to take a look at, or the council may want to take a look at.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. And yeah, that's the most glaring example that I can think of, that of things that happened since I've been in office. But there are other little smaller things. And, you know, I think one of the problems and one of the challenges that you have as the auditor is that people in D.C. really don't keep an eye on D.C. The people in power in D.C., and I don't mean the council and the people that work for the government, but I mean the citizens. We all focus, the people with money and power in this city, you know this because you live in Ward 3 and you're a council member in Ward 3. The people in the city can tell you more about Hillary Clinton than they can about Muriel Bowser. We focus on national politics. You know, I was raised in North New Jersey, and there neighborhood politics was everything. People, you know, we didn't care what the governor was doing. We didn't care. Everybody was focused on the mayor and the people but in D.C., I can't tell you how many people come to me every election year and say, who's this guy? Well, he's been your councilman for 26 years. Oh, do you know anything about the mayor? Yes, I do know some things about the mayor. Why don't you know anything about the mayor? You know, and it's true. We're all about to leave the city, and Ward 3 will be vacant next week because we're all going to Pennsylvania and Virginia, right? So that this crazy guy that was president doesn't get reelected. So
No, you're absolutely right, and I have the same thing. I still have a handful of former constituents who give me a call before every election and say, okay, Kathy, who do I vote for? Although I'm not a partisan official anymore. I'm not even an elected official anymore. But yes, that there is that residual. But, you know, every once in a while, the community really does rise up and demand something. And maybe it's been a while, but as I was exiting the council at the end of 2006, early 2007, there was a huge movement afoot across the city to fix our schools. And, you know, and we've seen what's happened in the 20 years since. There's been a huge amount of investment made, and virtually, you know, most of our school buildings are gorgeous now. So we really, that really was a community-wide effort. So every once in a while that does happen, where you have district residents who sort of rise up and say, look, we need something done about a priority here in the district.
Well, you're absolutely right about that. You know, my kids all went to Wilson High School. I think it's got another name now, but they went to Wilson High School. And my daughter didn't have a ceiling in the room where she took math. It was a disaster. And it's a beautiful place now. And I used to do some work at Eastern High School, and it's the same. All the high school renovations have just been amazing. And my wife, who was in charge of all D.C. public school libraries, and you were on the library committee, so I have to ask you this question for Mrs. Brown, but what can we do with libraries in the city and school libraries in particular? There's been this idea that's been generated that we don't need libraries anymore because we have the internet. You know, kids can Google everything. And what I find, because we use a lot of interns in our office, is I get kids that have no sense of doing research, or, you know, they can't get any further than Google. You know, they haven't learned. My wife, who's now a librarian in a high school in Fairfax, she's the head librarian of a huge high school. She teaches kids how to write their name and address on an envelope. They don't know how to write their names and addresses, and they're in high school. So, what do we? Anything we could do to to reinvigorate libraries?
Well, I mean, there's been a really strong constituency in the district, I think, for keeping school libraries. I mean, that was something where at one point in time there was a thought that, well, since we have our D.C. Public Library, which is another part of the government that has really improved its physical plant, that maybe we don't need school libraries anymore. But then I think that was another point where parents rose up and said, no, we need books in schools. And then I think there's been a pretty consistent, maybe a small group, but a pretty persistent and consistent group lobbying on behalf of school libraries. So, I mean, I think quality, you know, you're speaking to the quality of education. That's something that we do need to continue to be focusing on in terms of, like, not just literacy, but financial literacy as well.
Yeah, it's horrible that several years ago, and I think this has improved dramatically, but several years ago, maybe 6 or 7 years ago, when I checked, we were 50 out of 51 school systems in the country. So we were, our school system was below Alabama and Mississippi, which just shocked the hell out of me. And I know it's gotten a lot better since. So yeah, we still have to work at that. And you know, libraries, I mean, when my wife was an elementary school librarian at Janney Elementary, a school you know well, she was a rock star. All the children adored, when she walked into the building, all the children gathered around her because they loved the library. She never gave anybody homework. All she did was hug kids and help them read books. You know, she was great. First time I ran for office, anytime I would see a child, if I was knocking on doors, I'd do a knock. I'd say, "Do you know the school librarian?" And they go, "Yeah, Mrs. Brown. Yeah, I'm her husband." And they would look at me like, "That's crazy. We didn't know she had a husband." But anyway, I think I got a lot of votes for them.
I did something very similar in my first election. I had another very popular Janney staff person as my treasurer, so her name was on all the signs.
Yeah, my daughter. Yeah,
you do everything you can when you're trying to get votes.
Right, my daughter stood in front of Janney as an elementary school student on election day, screaming, "Vote for my dad! Vote for my dad!" And some woman walked up to her and said, "Honey, do people know who your dad is?" And she thought about it. And she went, "Oh yeah, vote for Mike Brown. Vote for Mike Brown." So, you know, yeah, you do everything you can think of. But and by the way, just let me give a shout out to your son Patrick, because when you ran for chairman of the city council, I ran for the first time for this office, and I stood out in front of several polling places with him in Ward 3. He's an amazing young man. and yeah, you should be very proud. I know you are.
Oh, I'm very proud of him. Absolutely. When I left the Wilson Building, he walked into it. He worked for my successor for a year as a legislative aide. So he put in his time at the Wilson Building too.
Well, and let me tell you something. I think the city would have been much better served if you were in that seat today. You were an amazing legislator, I think, and you're very kind. Well, not at all. The one thing that I have to talk, my one big Kathy Patterson grievance, is your legislation is what initiated the annual performance hearings. Now, it's a very important idea and it's very smart, but it's really a pain in the ass, but we have to do it. And every
you may find it a pain in the ass, but here's something that we do with every audit we start. And for anybody who doesn't know this, there's an immense amount of information about every government agency on that D.C. Council website because of the annual performance hearings. And so when we start an audit, one of the things our audit teams do is they mine that information for everything they can learn about the subject, about the agency, about the personnel working on a problem. So it is an amazing amount of information that gets generated. I would like to see it better used, you know, used more maybe, but I understand your point.
Well, you know, it's just in my case, I go up before a guy that really doesn't like me. And no matter what I say, it doesn't matter. You know, it just doesn't matter. The die is cast. You know, for the first 9 years I had this job, I didn't get a salary. I mean, I didn't get any money to work with. I've never gotten a salary. Worked 15 years full time with no salary. And we were never funded. And today we're funded. And the Office of Campaign Finance is auditing me for $100 in petty cash for a guy they haven't paid in 18 years. They want to know what I did with that $100, you know? It's annoying, but I understand.
but it's important, you know, you need to know where every $100 go in order to know where every $1 million goes. So
yeah. Well, when they give me $1 million, I'll tell you where it'll go. It'll go to like somewhere in an island country with no extradition, and me. I'll be there. But I don't think I'm going to get $1 million anytime soon. You know, can you explain to me? Because we've had a lot of problems with this lately with new council legislation. And that is that you put together a piece of legislation called the First Amendment Rights and Police Standards Act of 2004. What is that exactly?
That was legislation that came out of some very unfortunate experiences in 2000, 2001, 2002, where our police department did not handle itself well in managing demonstrations. And we did an investigation. We looked at sort of people being rounded up and hogtied and kept in a gymnasium and stuff for exercising their First Amendment rights. And it was a fascinating experience as a legislator, because one of the things we learned was that all the issues that we were seeing in some of the overreacting by our police department in that period of time were the same issues that happened in 1970, 1971 in some of the Vietnam War demonstrations. And we discovered that the Metropolitan Police Department had a great set of rules coming out of that circumstance and that litigation way back when. They just weren't following their own rules. And so one of the things that we did in that legislation that followed was to make some of things that had been general orders, we made some of those things statutory. And that law included things like, you know, police department everybody always has to wear their identification. So you can tell who you're dealing with if you're talking with an officer. You know, their identification is on the part of their uniform, part of their person. It precluded surrounding people and sort of forcing them down an alley, what's called kettling now. It precluded that. It put lots of rules around use of pepper spray. It did a whole lot of things that were just good policy in terms of policing. And today, as a result, you know, 20 years later, we have a department that is probably best in the nation at handling demonstrations. I mean, every once in a while there's a lapse, and every once in a while someone makes a mistake, but I think our department does incredibly well with all the demonstrations that we have in the city, and it's because we did so much. We did oversight. Then the department did training, all a part of enacting the law, but then the training had to follow. So the department, I think, has really made a name and a reputation for itself in that arena based on that legislation that we did almost 20 years ago.
Yeah, and thank you for that, because I agree with you 100%. DC cops are absolutely amazing, and we should never forget that they're the ones that saved the Capitol Police on January 6th. The Capitol Police were overrun, and the DC police came in and they neutralized the situation and got it under control. And, you know, this is coming from a guy, Kathy, who was beat up by the DC police in a demonstration when I was a teenager injured. We took the police officers involved. We took them before a hearing. Now when I deal with the DC police, they're always so helpful. They're always, you know, they always seem to go the extra mile. They're very, very, it's really surprising sometimes of how sensitive they are to public relations kind of attitude. And I think that your legislation, that's why I asked you about it, was really, really what's made that possible. And I got to tell the public this, I got to come clean. I'm getting so old that I went to speak at the big celebration we have in Chinatown for New Year's, and thousands of people show up, and I come out and I go to get my car, and my car's gone. So I go back to the, police, and I say, somebody stole my car. Now there's like 10 cops standing around doing nothing. So they all get on the case. and they get a description of the car and everything and blah, blah, blah. And then this one cop says, I'm going to walk around the block. And he walks around the block and he comes back and he says, Senator, I found a car in the next street that matches the description on your car, parked in front of a building that looks like this, and it has plates on it that say U.S. Senator. You think that could be your car? And I, of course, I looked at him and said, you mean somebody stole my car and drove it around the block? And the cop looked at me and said, yeah, and he parallel parked it too, which I thought, he said, parallel parked it too, which I thought was very nice. And I said, well, thanks, officer, will you? You know, and I said to my wife, I felt so stupid. All these cops were standing around shaking their heads like, oh, another old guy. But, you know, they deal with you. They deal with all that stuff, and they're really, really good about it. And I've been arrested by the Capitol Police for protesting in front of the Senate, and they're very good at it too. And I love their methodology. They're really, really polite about everything. And when they handcuff you and everything, you're just so sweet. But standing around you is four or five of the biggest people you've ever seen. So the message is like, okay, the best way to get through this is to go along. And so you do. And it's very good, which was surprising that they got so overwhelmed on January 6th. And God
bless. You mentioned January 6th, and it wasn't only our Metropolitan Police Department, but our other public safety folks, the Fire and Emergency Medical Services teams that were there too, just doing a great job in terms of all the injuries and having to handle. Mm. I mean, that was just such a horrible thing. Yeah,
it was a horrible, horrible thing, and I got to tell you, it's like somebody's sticking me with a needle every time I hear that guy call these people patriots. You know, they really, really did terrible damage. But let me ask you, how, when I was a contractor to politicians that ran for public office, like presidential campaigns, I dealt with vendors. I'm a Democrat, so I only dealt with union vendors. Most of them were in Maryland and Virginia. And I would ask them why they don't do business in the District of Columbia. And they would all say, I mean, it was universal. They'd say, you need to know somebody. It's very corrupt. You can't do business in the District of Columbia. And that was kind of the conventional wisdom, whether that was true or not, because, you know, I didn't, you know, that wasn't my experience. But that was the conventional wisdom out there. Is that, do people respect our government, you think, these days? The people outside the district.
I that's a very good question. I know we try very hard as a matter of public policy to do business with district businesses and so forth and so on, but there really are probably too many instances where we have rules and we have programs and we say, you know, we need to, you know, provide benefits to DC businesses, and yet you find that something, an entity has, there's a building in a street that has like 45 different businesses allegedly working out of that building and stuff like that. So yes, there are places and times and where some of these rules get bent and not respected. I think there's, you know, there may be some truth to it being difficult to do business in the district, but an awful lot of people do business in the district and have good experiences with some of our agencies and so forth. So I think, yes, you find the bad apples, but I think this is a good place to do business, and we just need to ensure that it is, and, you know, look to more oversight by our legislature, and look to, using the rules that we have, the laws that we have, and making sure that they're being enforced.
Well, and I got to tell you that our Attorney General, I don't know how closely you work with his office, but I think he's doing a really good job. And I think the former Attorney General did a pretty good job too. I think Brian is really trying hard with that stuff. And I don't know if you guys coordinate activity and stuff. I came to you, by the way, I came to your office with a problem. They referred me to Brian's office, and Brian's office did an amazing job at resolving the problem.
Good.
Yeah.
Good.
Oh, yeah.
We try to coordinate there, and I agree with you that Carl Racine and Brian Schwab have both really reinvigorated the whole idea of consumer protection in the District of Columbia. And I think some of the things they've done with housing vendors, some of the things they've done with you know, with other folks doing business in the city to make sure that folks are, you know, following the law. I think that's been a real resurgence in protection for consumer interests that we've seen in that office. And that's been a very good thing.
Yeah, I think so, too. And I think that, you know, one of the problems we've had with the council is that when it comes to policing, they passed a law that police officers can't review their body cam footage before, you know, it's publicly viewed or viewed by the government. And that's caused a lot of people think that's caused a lot of resignations and reluctance to hire officers in the District of Columbia. And, you know, and I was lambasted for calling them petulant children for sending a crime bill up to Capitol Hill to a conservative Republican Congress that ended up costing us 44 Democrats and the President of the United States. Support from those people who had always supported us turned against us because of the crime bill. These guys, you know, Kathy, I got to be honest, and you don't need to respond to this, but to pass a law that non-citizens can vote in local elections in this particular environment. I mean, this is just like giving these people a gift on these Republicans, a gift on Capitol Hill when they're saying that there are hundreds of thousands of illegal aliens, which is ridiculous, you know, voting illegally. You've run for
I've got to push back on one of those.
Okay.
You mentioned the Criminal Code Reform Commission that was sent to the Hill. The CCRC, Criminal Code Reform law, was the work of more than 15 years, hundreds of district residents working on that package of things to rewrite our criminal code. And let me tell you where that started. That started with a bill that I introduced in 2005. Sherrod Ambrose was my co-sponsor with that legislation to create a criminal code reform commission to work on revising our entire criminal code because it was so incredibly outdated. The first piece I did on that subject we call the Outdated Crimes Bill, and that was just a sampling of some of the absolutely outdated crimes. There was something in our code about, you know, docking horses' tails, and something else about, you know, being in the cab of a horse-drawn carriage, and just some really, really weird things that were still in the code, including, I might add, the absolute ban on abortion in the District of Columbia. If we hadn't removed those outdated crimes from the criminal code, you know, back in 2004, 2005, with this first bill we did, you know, who knows what would have happened when the Dobbs decision came down. But I say that to say that the criminal code reform law was very good piece of work. And when that went to Capitol Hill, we did a crap job of selling it. We did a terrible job of explaining what it really did and how important it was. I mean, we were sort of behind the scenes. A lot of states redid their criminal codes 20 years ago, so we were kind of behind in doing that. And that's a piece that's going to have to get revived and absolutely make some amendments to it, make some changes to it. But that was a piece of work that so many district residents worked on over, as I say, over like a 15-year period, that it was really a shame the way that went down. And some of the exaggerations that were made, some of the things that were said about what was in the bill and what wasn't in the bill, I am very much regret that that happened. And I'm sorry that we, the public officials in the district, didn't do a better job of explaining it to even to the Republicans on the Hill or to the White House. We certainly did a terrible job explaining it to the White House because it was very important piece of work.
Yeah, and I don't disagree with that. The code was 100 years old. There's still things. I sit on the board of directors of an international organization that deals with this horrible, horrible practice in third world countries, which goes on in the United States as well, and it's female genital mutilation, which in my humble opinion is the worst form of sexual child abuse I've ever heard of. And there's millions of women worldwide that are subjected to this. And you know what? It's not against the law in the District of Columbia. It's we've got legislation now before the council to make it against the law. There are only 9 places in the country where it's not against the law, and the District of Columbia is one of them. So reform, yes, 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 we need to reform the crime bill. I never had any problems with any of the provisions of it, but the mayor, who I often disagree with, I agree with her on this. She took out the thing about carjackings. She took out the thing about reducing the mandatory sentencing for murder and for carjackings, a sentence that's very seldom applied anyway, but they took it out. And she vetoed the bill on the basis of those two things. And I agree with you. They should have taken them out, and they should have done a better job of selling it, because
But the other thing was, it was going to go into effect in like 5 years.
You're right.
So there was ample time for the mayor to work with the council to amend what had been, you know, what had been developed by the commission. So there, I mean, there, again, the way it was handled was just not what it should be. And we need to do a much better job of working on the Hill. I mean, I know you're aware of that. We need to do a much better job, our elected officials, of meeting with members of Congress, of staying in touch with them, of having an ongoing dialogue. You know, it's kind of a shame that the last time we had a really good ongoing working relationship with Capitol Hill was, you know, you remember this, when Newt Gingrich was up there, for Pete's sake, you know, and we need to have an ongoing and very strong working relationship with many, many, many members. That's something that we need to do a better job of.
Do we need to elect a few Republicans? Is it, that's part of our problem too, isn't it?
Not necessarily. We can, you know, even an elected Democrat can meet with an elected Republican, you know? We need to work on the bipartisanship as well as everybody else in the country.
Yeah, you know, we really do. And you know, it's painful for me when I hear them sit up there and say, well, you don't need to be a state because you have 435 people in the House and 100 in the Senate who look after the people in Washington, D.C. I mean, we could all spontaneously combust it. I don't think any of you noticed it. You know, it's just crazy. But yeah, I agree with you. And it was time to reform the thing. I never had a problem with reforming the thing, but reforming the crime bill. But I had a problem with that, sending them up the way they did, just like you did, like you said. And I used the term petulant children, which people that. But that's all I could think of. I could think of my teenage daughters who used to make threats to me that they had no ability to carry out. You know, they would say things to me like, well, if I don't get a new cell phone, I'm just never going to eat again. And you go, okay, never eat again. We're having pizza for dinner, you know. But that's what it reminded me of. This is what we need to do, and we're going to do it, damn it. And we don't care what those people up there think. We're going to do it. And unfortunately for us, we always have to think of what those people up there are going to do, and we always have to. God help us if Donald Trump gets elected, because D.C. is really in the crosshairs for these people right now. They want to hold us up as an example of what their agenda is, and put us down because we're Democrats. You know, as you well know, there's only like 6 Republicans in the whole District of Columbia, and I think we put tracking devices on them. We put AirPods on them so we can track their movements. So, but yeah, we're really. It's a beautiful thing about being an elected Democrat, because after the primary, I used to go out on election day and just give donuts to everybody because you knew you're going to win. But we're running out of time here. So my last thing to you, and I don't know what, as the auditor, your advice could be here. Well, first, let me ask you, do we pay D.C. council members, and this is a loaded question, too much money because they're part-time employees and they make, in L.A., you make $218,000 a year as a council member, and it's a full-time job. You're not allowed to have a job. In D.C., the only council members that are not allowed to have outside employment are the chairman and the mayor, and they make $167,000. And the chairman makes $240,000. Are we paying them too much?
I don't think so, and they pretty much are working full time. So I understand that they can have, you know, you can have outside employment, but I don't think, I don't even know if any of them do at this point. They are, and they should be, and are, I think, pretty much full time jobs. That's certainly the way I approached it when I was there.
Yeah, and I think most people do, because it is a full-time job. I mean, you know, it's not like you can go off, you know, work from 8 to 4 and then go take another job. But yeah, we've had people that were college professors and, you know, and people like David Catania, who worked for one of the city contractors. He sat on the board of a contractor for the city that made, that did millions and millions of dollars worth of business with the city every year. And he was on the board of directors and made more than $200,000 in addition to his council salary. But I don't think anybody does that really anymore. And that leads me to my final area that I want to talk to you about, and that's corruption in the District of Columbia. Since I've been elected, Harry Thomas and Michael Brown have gone to jail for taking bribes or taking money. Treyon White is under indictment right now, and it really looks like they have a lot of evidence against him, and it also looks like he's going to get resoundingly reelected in the District of Columbia. I'm one of those public officials that think if you take a bribe, that ought to be a disqualifier. But it isn't, you know, if the voters put you in, they put you in. And it's likely that he'll get reelected and then really not even make it through his term, right? If he gets convicted, he can't get to his term. In addition to that, the people that left government or were defeated in reelection because of malfeasance were Jack Evans, Vincent Orange, Jim Graham, and our mayor, Vincent Gray, was under investigation for 4 years by the federal government. Is there anything we can do to stem this in the District of Columbia? And I say, you know, I think part of this is what I said earlier, that we focus on national politics and we don't worry enough about the local guys.
You know, I think I would go back. There are a couple things I could say about that. One thing, sort of wearing my ex-council member hat, I know I testified way back in like 2011 or so when the council was considering ethics legislation and did the legislation that created the Board of Ethics and Government Accountability, BEGA. And one of the things that I said in my testimony then was, I think the council should police itself. And one of the ways in which legislatures can self-police is to have their own, for example, like an executive committee that handles any kind of ethical violations. And something like that, that is an ongoing, permanent part of the legislative structure, would be a place where people could take complaints or could take issues or take concerns about any members. It's hard to be part of a legislature and to police your colleagues. But if you have the 13 members, say you have a 3-person or a 5-person executive committee that's mandate included ethics, then there would be a place, a permanent structure that you could turn to. And one of the other things that I know I said in that testimony was, if someone is accused in a credible way of wrongdoing, then they should immediately forfeit their committee roles, or their, you know, the council gives a committee chairmanships, the council can take it away. And I think things that would be automatic are swift and sure, and I think better than having anything that's an ad hoc approach. So I think there are some ways in which the legislature could itself give itself more of a self-policing kind of powers, not having it be ad hoc, not creating an ad hoc committee, which is what they're doing now. I mean, that's better than nothing, but I think something that's permanent would be better. And the other thing that I would say about corruption in government more generally, we at this office are in the business of identifying risk. And I even joke sometimes when I'm doing community presentations that in the office of the DC auditor, we get to find people guilty, before proven, by saying right. there's a risk of fraud here, even if we haven't proven fraud. It's our job to identify risk. And there are risks certainly today in some of the ways in which we, for example, do our procurements. We have a structure of procurements across some of our programs where the government hires nonprofit entity and has that nonprofit entity let government contracts. That makes the accountability business much more difficult. If we had a rule or a law or something that said only a government employee can let a contract, that would then give you more immediate accountability. But now we have these layers in terms of our procurement structure where the government agency hires someone, they hire someone, they hire someone, and then they hire someone to do the real work. You know, this kind of sort of multi-layer in procurement practice is something that is a risk. It's a risk, and it also makes accountability more difficult because you have many, many more layers to hold accountable. You can't just say, you know, Michael Brown or Kathy Patterson let this contract, therefore is responsible. Mm-hmm. So those are just a couple of points that I would make on that general, on the topic of corruption.
Well, and I think there are points well made. And, you know, let me ask you, so this would be members of the council that would be it would be a permanent committee of the council made up of council members, three council members who would investigate, or would it have outside investigators as well?
But it just depends on what the issue would be. I mean, for example, if you had a management committee and there was a member of the council who looked to be misbehaving, you know, that committee could hear the complaints and meet with that person and say, straighten up and fly right, and then nothing further might happen. But when you make everything ad hoc and you make every person weigh in on an issue, that just makes it much more difficult. And again, I'm referring back to some testimony that I gave some years ago, and I think I still think that was probably a sound idea to have a committee that's in charge of some of the management issues at the council. That's just a different approach to how you share leadership within a legislative body.
Yeah, I think that's true, I think that would help, and I think we do need help, and it's hard, very hard to police yourself. But let me ask you before you leave, you're a former journalist. You work for the Kansas City Star newspaper.
Yep.
We've seen a serious decline in newspapers around the country. A few weeks ago, I had a New York Times reporter on, and the reporter said that his biggest concern right now in the newspaper industry is that the few big newspapers that are left are going to pander to, vendors because they need the business. So he said, for example, just a simple example, if there's a gun shop that's giving you revenue, taking out full page ads in your newspaper, are you really going to do an expose on gun violence or, gun control? And that's what he worries about. What do you think about the decline in newspapers? I'm sure you've seen it and realized it.
Well, no, absolutely, and I so regret it. I so regret that my morning paper, when I pick it up, is less heavy than it used to be. Yes, absolutely, and when I left the council, people said, are you going to go back into journalism? I said, well, there's no journalism to go back into, because right. The jobs are so scarce. But there, here in the district, there is some legislation before the council to try to provide public support for journalism. It's a bill that Janice Lewis George introduced. And I think that's something that I hope there's a hearing on it to at least talk about whether there is some other way to somehow help be supportive of local journalism. I think there are a lot of different models around the country that are being looked at these days because it's so important to have that the fourth estate out there to sort of help keep all of us honest. And then the other thing that I do sometimes say, with a smile on my face, is if you're a journalist and you can't find work, come work for me, because it's the same kind of work. We investigate, we research, we have findings, we have recommendations. So I'm certainly open to taking some of the journalists off the market and putting them to work here at the D.C. Auditor's Office, because the work is so similar. But it is really important to have the journalists out there helping keep us all accountable in public service, in government, absolutely.
Yeah, and that's great. And, people that come to me for advice and ask what I should do, young people, we have a lot of interns, I say, go out and be a bartender. You want to learn how to deal with people, be a bartender for a while. And that'll teach you how to talk to people and how to relate to them. And that's what you need to know if you're going to be a campaigner. Kathy Patterson, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you. This has been fun.
And you know what? I dedicate a song to our, we lead with a song every week, and I dedicate a song to the person that's been on the show. And this song goes to you, Kathy Patterson, from every taxpayer in the District of Columbia. This is from Ira Gershwin. It's Someone to Watch Over Me, sung by Ella Fitzgerald. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Take care.
My regards to Patrick. You have a great week. Thanks, Kathy.
We'll see you all next week.
Thanks for tuning in.
There's a saying old says that love is blind. Still, we're often told, seek and you shall find. So I'm going to seek a certain lad I've had in mind.
Representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their